I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. The UN estimates that over the past year, more than 380,000 people have fled war and poverty in the Middle East and Africa, traveling to Europe in search of a better life. The response to the crisis has been mixed. While Hungary has erected a fence to keep asylum seekers out, Germany has agreed to resettle 1 million refugees. Today, a look at the response to the refugee crisis by Maryland-based relief agencies. We'll hear from those who've been on the front lines in Serbia and Syria. Plus, how will Europe find room for the thousands of refugees who may never be able to return home? And what will happen to those who do not qualify for asylum? What should be the U.S. response? All that's coming up on Midday after the news from NPR. Good afternoon, one and all. Dan Rodericks here. It's another edition of Midday. Glad you could join us and make Midday part of your day. The United Nations estimates that over the past year, more than 380,000 men, women, and children have fled to Europe seeking refuge from war, escape from poverty, and better economic opportunities, leaving countries from across the Middle East, Africa, and South Asia. Most are from Syria. According to the United Nations, more than 4 million Syrians have left their country since civil war broke out there in 2011. Others are traveling from countries such as Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, Eritrea, and Somalia. Based on UN data, approximately 2,800 people have died trying to reach Europe. Last month, at least 200 people drowned in one incident off the coast of one of Libya's main people smuggling hubs. They were believed to have been trying to reach Italy. In Austria, the bodies of 71 dead refugees were found in an abandoned truck. And earlier this month, a photograph went viral. You know the one. It showed the body of a 3-year-old Syrian boy who drowned off the coast of Turkey while his family was trying to reach Greece. European nations have had a mixed response to the crisis. Border controls throughout Europe have tightened. Hungary, the main corridor for those trying to reach Germany and northern Europe, has erected a fence along its southern border with Serbia and plans to extend that fence eastward along its border with Romania. This has trapped some refugees and migrants in Serbia while forcing others to try to take alternate routes through Croatia. On Monday, Germany announced that it would welcome up to 1 million refugees for resettlement, revising its previous commitment to accept 800,000 of them. Britain has faced criticism for its plan to accept 20,000 Syrian refugees over the next 5 years. What will happen to the thousands of people who have left their homes for a new life in Europe? Will those deemed migrants rather than refugees be forced to leave? What should the American response be? We're going to deal with all these questions in this first hour of Midday today. Later on, we'll hear from Mike Mitchell of the Baltimore-based Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service, the second largest resettlement group in the U.S. Mike Mitchell is just back from Detroit, where he met with several resettled Syrian families. He'll tell us about that. The U.S. plans to resettle at least 10,000 Syrian refugees over the next year. And we'll speak to representatives from International Orthodox Christian Charities, IOCC, which is another Baltimore-based humanitarian organization doing great work around the world. They've been on the ground in Serbia and Syria. Our guests will be joining us a little bit later on. But we start the show with Cortland Robinson. Cortland Robinson is an assistant professor at the Center for Refugee and Disaster Response at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Cortland Robinson studies global patterns in migration and health. And we asked him on the show. He recently wrote an op-ed in The Sun about the refugee crisis in Europe, but comparing it to a crisis he's very familiar with and many of us of a certain age are familiar with from the 1970s and early 80s, when an estimated 3.5 million refugees from Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, from Southeast Asia fled their homes or were displaced, many of them known as the boat people from that time. So, Cortland Robinson, nice to have you on the show with us. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
I want to talk about the boat people in just a moment to give this little historic perspective here, and especially when we talk about solutions and what agencies and governments can be doing. But first, a survey of what you see transpiring here this all seems to have come to a head just in the last 2 or 3 weeks in Europe.
Indeed. But I think to understand what's been happening in the last few weeks and months, we have to go back a little bit in time. You alluded to the conflict. We've called it a civil war. I think it really is an international conflict in Syria of devastating impact on the population. Population of total 17 million, about 12 million conflict affected. Of these, 7 million internally displaced. You mentioned the 4 million who are refugees in the region, Turkey, Lebanon, and Jordan bearing the largest numbers of these refugees in regional camps and settlements in the Middle East.
For 4 years now.
For 4 years now. Yeah. And I think we've seen really Syrians beginning to abandon hope that the conflict will end. I think that's the root cause and it needs to be addressed. But even in the camps and settlements outside of Syria, funding appeals are now met with only about 40% positive response. World Food Program has cut back on its food aid. So the situation is deteriorating in the region. So if you see a population really losing hope that the war will ever end, that there's any hope for peace, security, and a stable future for them inside the country, that regional options are deteriorating, it makes perfect sense for any human being on this earth, I think, to understand why people in those circumstances say, I've got to find something better, even if it means putting myself in the hands of smugglers and traffickers, putting myself out on a unseaworthy vessel across the Mediterranean or trying to push across a land border through Greece, Serbia, Hungary, and so forth. Along with the Syrians, as you mentioned, there are large numbers of Afghans, Eritreans, Somalis, others who may have refugee claims and reasons for fleeing well-founded fear of persecution, but may also be migrants seeking opportunity. And I think one of the challenges for Europe and for the world is how to sort through the different claims that people have for protection. We would argue that everyone as a human being deserves treatment with dignity, a safe place to stay, have food, water, temporary shelter. But longer term, how to sort out those who have a claim to refugee status and deserve a right to remain, including permanent resettlement, as well as those who have claims as immigrants, may be returned to a place of a safe country of origin, as it's referred to, or move on as migrants into other with other opportunities, but different levels and kinds of protection. I think it's not about protect refugees and don't protect the others, but find the adequate and appropriate protection mechanisms for all of these different populations in this mixed flow, but focus first and foremost, I think, on those who have refugee claims. That's the Syrians in the largest numbers and certainly with some of the most imperative claims on our humanitarian priorities, but not to exclude the other populations either.
Sort something out for us, would you please, Courtland Robinson? EU, the European Union, when refugees or migrants reach a EU country, what happens to them in terms of seeking asylum, seeking a temporary place to live?
There are protocols, and I don't want to get too technical, within the countries that are within the so-called Schengen zone. There are, one hopes, reasonably harmonized asylum procedures. They're not actually entirely harmonized. I think this is one of the problems. Hmm. But generally speaking, someone who comes in and presents themselves to an authority saying, I am claiming asylum, I seek asylum, there should be a vetting process where their claim is interpreted to be either refugee or not. If refugee, they may grant them immediate asylum and are processed on for settlement in that country. Other claims, if rejected, they may be placed into some form of deportation or simply denied the status that comes with being determined to be a refugee. The EU granted about 100,000 claims to asylum last year, so there is space for this. I think what's happened in the last few weeks and months is the numbers are really overwhelming that capacity to process quickly and have prompted a number of countries, I think Hungary perhaps the most egregious, if you will, that simply says we won't take them, we'll move them on, now we won't even move them on, we'll wall them off, shut them out. So you've put them at sort of one pole in terms of the response, and I think Germany at the other end.
Certainly
which is
at
saying,
the other end, yeah.
We've taken it, probably expect 800,000 asylum seekers. We may take as many as 1 million. I think that kind of humanitarian commitment, I hope, will be matched by others rather than saying, well, if they're taking them, we don't have to do as much. And that's really about sharing responsibility, taking that fair share.
Does it seem to you that in terms of a Syrian person or Syrian family with children, that assumptions can be made about why they've shown up in Hungary or any other EU country, that, you know, the place is a mess. Maybe they've lost their home. Do you have to prove that you're a refugee? Do you have to prove that you're seeking asylum?
I think there is an individual status determination. There are sometimes situations in which a sort of a group determination is made. We did this in the case of Indochinese. If you cross by sea and you're Vietnamese and you end up in a camp, there was a kind of, using the Latin term, prima facie, sort of a on-face mm-hmm. determination that you were very likely to be a refugee and were processed as such. I think the UN High Commissioner for Refugees in the context of Syrians, as they've looked at these cases, have determined that at least two-thirds would meet kind of immediate, obviously recognizable claims to a well-founded fear of persecution for race, religion, nationality, membership of a social group, or political opinion. Others may be somewhat grayer, but we have always argued on a humanitarian basis, benefit of the doubt, and at least first instance protection so that your claim can be processed not at the point of a gun, certainly not standing at a fence with a very sheltered and inhospitable environment, but in a place where you can make your claim and have due process of law carried out, whether you're a migrant or a refugee. But I think the Syrians do, I think, as a population, represent a group fleeing war, human rights abuse, and hardship of many different kinds that would make them, in the very large degree, refugees by anyone's determination.
A lot of people smile when they saw the response of Angela Merkel, the German chancellor, to this, saying, you know, upping it from 800,000, which was impressive, to 1 million. What do you make of her gesture there?
I think it's remarkable.
Just trying to lead the way in the EU?
Yeah, I hope so. One can talk about, you know, why Germany is doing what it's doing and what it could have done perhaps more to deal with some of the regional concerns in Syria, addressing the civil conflict and so forth. But I think that kind of humanitarian gesture just stands for itself. And I think it speaks to the kind of leadership that's needed in Europe and internationally to take those bold strokes, the big moves, the large scale commitments that are going to be needed to respond to this now global crisis.
Is there some agency in place, United Nations or some other agency that sees these things coming? The CIA, NSA? I mean, we must be able to predict movement like this, right? Because you just laid out the chronology of why you think this happened, right? These folks were in camps in Turkey, Lebanon, Jordan. I'm just speaking of the Syrians now, right? It's kind of predictable that they would move on at some point if aid were to evaporate or be diminished.
Absolutely. We've seen this time and again, and I think there were warnings put forward by UN High Commissioner for Refugees and others. I think it's not possible exactly to predict this many people will come from Libya by boat to Italy, but we know that when people cannot face a likely future with stability and security in their own country, they will leave to another country. And when the conditions in those what we call first asylum countries deteriorate, people will move from there. They simply will not put up with situations that are intolerable, certainly not for years. And I think that's what we've seen. So we knew this was going to break at some point, absent a resolution of the conflict or in vast improvement of conditions in these camps and places of settlement in the region. Lacking that, I think there was a general expectation that something was going to deteriorate. As migration flows often do, some first kind of adopters of a solution begin to move. Others look at that and say, oh, well, if my cousin, my friend, other countries are moving by boat to Italy, I can do that. Now with the internet and social media and cell phones being as ubiquitous as they are, really, in effect, there's an app for finding out how to leave, how much it costs, where to go. And, of course, there's many people, including many criminal elements, who are very happy to exploit that desire to move for financial gain and put people at terrible risk.
I have occasion once or twice a year to drive through central Pennsylvania And on my trek there, I go past Fort Indiantown Gap, west of Harrisburg, I think I'm right. I think that's where it is. Anyway, it always reminds me of 1975, the fall of Saigon, and the years after that, when the boat people were arriving in the United States. And I believe that's one of the places where our government encamped a lot of refugees from Southeast Asia, right?
Exactly. In 1975, right after the fall of Saigon, we set up camps in the United States. I think we found over a few years that was really not ideal and began to push more for resettlement from countries or camps in the region, Thailand, Malaysia, Indonesia, and so forth. But I know Fort Indiantown Gap. Our family helped resettle a Vietnamese family out of Fort Indiantown Gap.
Is that right?
So that, although I've grown up in Asia, I knew Asia even before all of this crisis. I think it was just a reminder that, you know, we all have commitments. And I think the U.S. did the right thing to take very large numbers.
What was the right thing? So I bring it up for a reason, because this is what you wrote about it in your op-ed in The Sun.
Right. The picture of that, tragic picture of that drowned boy off the coastline was so evocative to me of images not only that I'd seen in photographs, but have seen personally, have witnessed as we were working in the field to help rescue boats. That one, we've seen this kind of large-scale crisis before, and two, that we have models that we can look to for large-scale international response. And in 1979, the world came together and said, we will provide large-scale aid to countries in the region like Malaysia, Thailand, Indonesia, Philippines, Hong Kong, who were bearing the initial brunt of the outflow, not just by boats, but in Thailand's case, overland from Cambodia and Laos. And we will provide not only international aid and support for camps and settlements in the region, but we will provide large-scale resettlement of refugees. And the U.S., I think, was among the countries in the lead over time. We resettled out of the camps and directly out of Vietnam nearly 2 million people. So that's a substantial commitment.
We felt some responsibility there because we had waged the Vietnam War, right?
Exactly. But I think it was also about this is the right thing to do on the part of the international community. And I think in many ways it was kind of a win-win situation. The countries in the region were supported in their efforts to provide first asylum. The world came together and said, we will provide ongoing resettlement. In 1989, that began to break down as other countries, both resettlement countries and countries of asylum, said, we didn't commit to this forever, and we're worried that we're now drawing out not just refugees, but people who are seeking opportunity.
Who paid for it, Corey?
It was the world. I mean, there was the major donors, the usual sort of U.S., Japan, Western Europe, and I hope that those countries will stand up again and are doing so already, but I think we can now look and hope to see aid coming from other places like China, the Middle Eastern countries, which I think really, frankly, need to step up their game and make much more substantial financial commitments and other commitments to help resolve this crisis. But the point is the international model of large-scale interlocking commitments is there. I'm not saying that model fits in all respects. There's things that were omitted from that I think should be thought about. But it does represent a successful case example of how we've done this kind of global response in the past.
Cortland Robinson with me in Studio A here at WYPR today, assistant professor at the Center for Refugee and Disaster Response at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health right here in Baltimore. This is Midday. We're going to take a break. We'll come back and talk some more about the refugee crisis. We'll speak with some people who have seen firsthand the challenges faced by refugees and migrants, including Maryland-based food and travel writer Diana Love. She'll describe what she saw during a recent trip to Hungary. We'll also hear from representatives of International Orthodox Christian Charities who've been working on the ground in Syria and Serbia. And later this hour, the United States has agreed to take in at least 10,000 Syrian refugees over the next year. What challenges will they face when they come to the States? So please stay with us. Welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here, speaking in this hour about the refugee crisis in Europe, a crisis in which thousands of people from Syria, Afghanistan, Somalia, other war-torn countries have fled their homes. They've traveled some by sea in makeshift crafts, some by land, crossing borders by night to Europe in search of a better life. Cortland Robinson is with us for the hour, associate professor at the Bloomberg School of Public Health. He's at the Center for Refugee and Disaster Response over there. Always impressed at the what goes on at Bloomberg, finding out about all different centers and agencies within that school. So it's great to have you with us, Cortland. And joining us now by phone, I wanted to say hello and speak with, just for a few minutes, Diana Love. Diana Love is a Maryland-based food and travel writer. She contributes to the Capital Gazette newspaper. She writes a column, but she was traveling recently in Hungary, and during her time there, she went to the train station in Budapest, where thousands of refugees were camped out. And she wrote about this for the Cap Gazette, so we thought we'd get her on the show to talk a little bit about what she saw there. Diana Love, thank you for joining us on the Midday Show.
Thank you so much for having me.
You traveled to Hungary, I assumed, for a little vacation and some writing about food and what you, and the travels through Hungary, right?
I did. I was very excited to go there.
Well, so tell us, how did you step into the refugee crisis? How did you first become aware of that?
You know, my friends ask me the same thing. I became aware of it on the news, mostly, because it really, truly was what everybody was talking about. And so I don't know, I felt very compelled to go and see what was really happening there. I knew it was close, and so I just decided to go. I just felt drawn to the situation.
Okay. And so I just wish you would describe for us what you saw there, that train station, which I guess has since been cleared of refugees, but when you were there, it was full of refugees.
Yes, when I was there, it had about 3,000 refugees. I suppose that, you know, for someone who hasn't been there, you would have to imagine Times Square with, you know, underneath where the subway runs, body to body, just filled with families, children playing soccer, mothers, you know, trying to round up the kids or get them fed, young men just sitting there sort of waiting to learn what was going to happen to them next. It was a stirring scene, for sure.
And where were they coming from? Were they mostly Syrian?
They were mostly Syrian. There were some Afghanis when I was there, also some Pakistanis, but by far the majority were Syrian.
And was there talk in the train station about refugee camps in Hungary?
Oh, very much. So when I actually went there twice and spent several hours there, and in the people that I spoke to, there are camps, but they did not want to go to them. They were adamant that they did not want to go. And that is why they stayed in the train station. They just wanted to get to Germany, and they weren't going to risk the opportunity to miss a train that would go there.
I see. And they were worried about what might happen if they went to a camp in Hungary?
Yeah, I would say worry maybe isn't strong enough a word. Mm. They were petrified about going to the camps. Mm. They were worried. I mean, many of them said the camps are absolute squalor. They're filthy. I really don't know how they would know that, because once you get to the camp, you're not going to go back to Budapest. Hmm. But many of them were also worried that they would get to the camp and Hungary would keep them there indefinitely, or that they would be, you know, fingerprinted and registered at the camp and Hungary would say, you're not a true refugee, back to Syria you go. So for many reasons, they refused to go to the camp, and they were very scared of going to the camp.
Hmm. Diana, while those folks were in the train station, did they have food, water to drink? Did they carry food with them? Were they given some aid?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question, because so many papers reported that they were starving down there, which was not what I saw at all. There's a group in Budapest called Migrant Aid, and people were distributing food and you know, water through that office. Also, in Budapest, they're allowed to walk around. Many of them were too afraid of being caught by the police and being sent to the camps to do that. So a couple of them that I spoke to would once or twice a day run across the street to the Burger King and get something and bring it back to their wife or children. But most of them were relying on aid. I can't imagine that very many of them carried food and water with them. They'd traveled hundreds and thousands of miles. So I don't imagine that they did that, but they were finding a way to survive in this incredible situation.
Hmm. And Diana, thank you for joining us. What did you do on the rest of your trip there? Was that it for you, mostly Hungary? Did you go elsewhere?
I stayed mostly in Hungary. It just really has so much to offer. And with only 10 days, I needed to focus on what I was doing there. But yes, I stayed mostly in Hungary.
Well, thank you very much for joining us today. And I'll tell folks again, on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page, you can find links to Diana Love's stories in the Capital Gazette about her experiences there in Hungary during this crisis. Thank you, Diana.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much, Diana Love. I want to introduce our next guest and then ask a question about Hungary. Joining us now, Nenad Prelevich and Mark Ohanian. They are representatives from the International Orthodox Christian Charities, which is another Baltimore-based humanitarian agency. We have Catholic Relief Services here.
Lutheran World Relief.
Lutheran World Relief. We're going to meet a representative from that organization in just a few minutes. Thank you very much, Mark Ohanian. Mark Ohanian is IOCC's program director for their Syria response. So it's nice to have you with us. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And Nenad Prelevich is joining us from Serbia, where he's been there for quite a while for the IOCC, I guess since the breakup of the former Yugoslavia, right?
Correct.
And you, Nenad, you've worked in agriculture a lot in Serbia, is that right?
Yes, I did.
Trying to get farmers established?
Trying to help small farms and small farmers to survive of that, what they are doing, being aware of the falling apart of Yugoslavia, that many industry collapsed and lots of businesses were lost. So agriculture became a prime occupation for people to survive. And having in mind that we are talking about small surfaces, it was extremely important to help them to stay back on their feet and to continue their lives.
I wish you would all just address the question of Hungary for a moment, including Cortland Robinson. Why this strong response to this crisis from Hungary? Is it because the country was concerned about being overwhelmed? Is it because of where it stands geographically, a concern about being overwhelmed? Why the response that we've seen from Hungary?
I think it's there's a lot of elements to that. First of all, the numbers are overwhelming, is overwhelming Europe, which surprises us a little bit, because you report on the number that came to Europe, 360,000 refugees that came. We need to put that in perspective and look at the numbers of the neighboring countries that have been hosting the Syrian refugees, and they're in millions. In the case of Lebanon and Jordan, they're roughly each, they're hosting 20% of their population today are Syrian refugees. And we're talking about 1.2 million and 1 million refugees in Lebanon and Jordan. And that in itself, it puts massive strain on those countries. And yet the assistance and the support that these countries are getting, they're definitely not commensurate to the needs on the ground. And I would even go further in saying that the infrastructure in those places, they're on the verge of collapse. You know, what I mean by the infrastructure is the education system, the healthcare system, and they are relying on the already existing weak structures before the refugees came into those countries. And now at least a million have been added, and then some reports even suggest it's even more than a million. And we're talking about, by the way, when we talk about Syrian refugee figures, we're talking about those who are registered with the UNHCR and not those who chose not to register for various reasons with the UN.
Hmm. So that could be, are there estimates on that number?
In Lebanon, for instance, officially the number of refugees are approximately 1.2 million. We think the real number is closer to 1.7 million. In the case of Jordan, officially the number is, I believe, 600,000, 700,000.
700,000.
Yeah,
right.
So, but the number is probably closer to 1 million.
Cortland, do you have anything else to add about Hungary's response?
I think Hungary, the response is partly geographic, partly political. Again, because of the way EU asylum policies and the so-called Schengen Agreement set up, Hungary sees itself as a frontline state. People coming from Serbia, which is not party to these agreements, Hungary worries that if they allow them even to set foot on their soil under what's called the Dublin Regulation, they would have the first obligation to provide them with asylum and possibly resettle refugees. So they're basically saying, we don't want that to happen on our soil. We will keep them out. It is also partly a matter of politics. Hungary and some of the other Eastern European countries are saying, we don't have a history of providing sanctuary and resettlement to refugees. I think that's actually something they could just learn how to do, as other countries have. But there's partly politics going on, internal politics, which is A very real issue. So there's a lot of sort of nationality movements and conversations going on. These are not the sort of people that Hungary or Poland or others would want to resettle in large numbers. That complicates the conversation about which country should take whom, how many, and of what kind. There are Muslims, there are Christians, there are people of many different colors and nationalities and ethnicities. And these are challenging, I think, a lot of the ways in which European countries have often thought about who they are as a people. Obviously, our hope, speaking on behalf, I hope, of the humanitarian community, is we must overcome those more parochial views and say what is necessary for humanity to take and respond in our fair share. And I think I believe most people would feel that Hungary is not doing that. They're pushing this back onto Serbia and other countries, and hopefully we'll look to Germany and other countries that have stepped up and say we can do our share as well.
Nenad Prelevic, I wonder if you would just take a minute and describe what you've seen of this crisis in the last couple of weeks before you returned here to the U.S.
Well, I would like if people can just imagine mother, father with the children, all belongings is a backpack, and they are thousands of miles away of the home that they are not certain they will ever again return. And where they are going, they are not certain as well. Right now, we have over 120,000 of people who are in Serbia officially registered, and we have, by some estimations, more than 50,000-60,000 of those who are not. On daily basis, between 4,000 and 5,000 people comes in addition to it. And what is happening right now is the situation that European Union is trying to find a way how to deal with that. Some countries are closing the borders, and these people are coming to Serbia anyway. They are staying in Serbia, many of them in Greece. So how the winter is approaching, and we are talking about extremely harsh winters that are in that area. We are concerned what will be with the hundreds of thousands of people whose situation will not be resolved, who will not be able to move forward, and they will stay in the area, in the region of Greece to Serbia, settled where? That is a big question.
That was my question. Where are they? Where did you see them in Serbia? Were they in vacant lots, old buildings, on farms? Where did you see them?
They are next to the main roads and railway tracks because they do believe this is the fastest and shortest way so they will reach their destination. I fully understand why they are not going to the camps because usually they are out of their routes and they are afraid they will lose a track of the people that they departure with. I would like to emphasize that over a time, these people are traveling together for months, various friendships and dependency has been created among themselves. And they are afraid because small groups, 10 to 20 people, that's like a family. Most probably before the crisis, they didn't know for each other. But now they are surviving, helping each other. So they cannot split. They cannot go from the root. And as well, I would like to emphasize what is happening in Serbia is that what is happening during the whole tradition of Serbian people, and that is great deal of empathy to these people, because ourselves facing devastating wars, we know exactly how it is being a refugee, how it is to leave the home. Right. And the response that is now existing from the international community wouldn't even help a close without a response of the local people. And we are talking about a country where one-third is in need, either socially or economically, but it does not stop them to share.
Thank you very much, Nenad. And Mark Ohanian, I'll go to you. The IOCC, again, we're talking about the International Orthodox Christian Charities, which is based here in Baltimore and is on the ground in several countries. We should mention, you mentioned Lebanon, Jordan and Greece, and Serbia, of course, where Nenad is. Food, water, clothing, is this all being provided by IOCC and other groups?
We are definitely inside Syria and in the neighboring countries, and we've been responding to the crisis, the Syrian crisis, since early 2012 when the humanitarian calamity came to the surface. But the sad reality is that, and I'll share my personal experience in being in Syria a few times this year, there is some resemblance of services being provided in the areas that we operate. However, those resources are being depleted, and these structures are close to collapsing, similar to in Lebanon and Jordan. And we need to be realistic on this. This is a country that's been at war, very vicious and ugly war with thousands of death and destruction for about 5 years now. And every time I visit Syria since 2012, if you compare the situation from before that, it's getting worse. It's not getting better. The needs are growing. They're not diminishing. This is despite of the millions and millions of dollars that's being spent in humanitarian assistance in those countries. And we need to be thankful also for the U.S. government for being really a pioneer in this, in the humanitarian assistance, which is the leader in providing assistance. But
why is it getting worse?
Because the war is not stopping. Simple as that. There is no resemblance of agreement on how to resolve the crisis, and we need leadership in this. We need political leadership. The solution to this crisis is not humanitarian aid. We're, as a humanitarian organization, as IOCC and other organizations doing this work, we're dealing with the consequences. So one of the most important things that needs to happen is that political leadership to give hope also to the Syrian people, because if we give hope that we are, or those countries, the United States, Europe, and others, working towards a solution in a meaningful way, and which we're not seeing that so far, then we will see a significant decrease in migration of people in Europe. Because many Syrians do not wish to leave. They want to be where they are. They're not leaving because they want to be in Sweden or Germany or other places. They are attached to their land. So we need to invest in that. And we can if we want to, but we need to make political compromises if we need to.
I can't spend too much time on the politics, but you say there's nothing going on there with the Assad government, and Assad is fine to let people leave the country as they wish, or is he trying to contain Syrians at all?
I think the people of Syria will do whatever they can do to get a better life. And for now, their life is deteriorating as we speak. Education is collapsing. Children are unable to go to school, either for financial reason or security reasons because they don't access their school, or because overcrowded. And many heads of households, the majority, are unable to generate any income. They're, even in places that are not directly affected by the conflict, there's no economic activity that can sustain them. As a result, they turn to a better future. They turn to Europe and other places.
The International Orthodox Christian Charities then just expects to keep doing this for the foreseeable future. You don't see any end to this in sight, I guess.
We don't have another choice. Yeah. We are not seeing the light at the end of the tunnel, but we also have the moral obligation to do whatever we can to help these people. I'm afraid to say we're not doing nearly enough, but we also don't see ourselves just stepping back and saying we can't do much. We need to continue to provide whatever support that we can. But in the meantime, parallel to that, we also need a political solution.
One last thing, Nenad Prelevic, I mentioned that you had been working in agriculture a lot with Serbians, right?
Yes.
This is a different role for you now, dealing with refugees coming from another country. So your work there certainly has changed, hasn't it?
Well, probably that is just a different group of people, but the needs are the same. We are talking about the people who fight for their families and for their lives. So probably it will be different activity, but certainly it will not be different issue we are dealing here, and that is helping those that really needs our assistance. And sadly to say, but at this point of time, they don't have too many choices, and it is, thanks God, our presence on the field now in the extent with the support of the Serbian Orthodox Church and Red Cross that we can actually do something for them. Especially I would emphasize, winter is approaching quickly and we will have thousands and thousands of women and children on open. This is something that will be our immediate goal, how to handle that and to help these people to go through it. When it will be resolved, we don't know. But in the meantime, these people have to live and to survive, because whatever solution is tomorrow, if they are not with the solution, then we failed.
Nenad Prelevic is the representative in Serbia for the International Orthodox Christian Charities based here in Baltimore. And Marco Hanian is IOCC's program director for the Syria response. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you, Dan.
Thank you for inviting
me. Yes, thank you. We're going to take a break, and when we get back, we'll be speaking with Mike Mitchell, Vice President for Programs and Protection at Lutheran Immigration and Relief Services, who has just returned from a trip to Detroit, where he met with several Syrian refugee families. So a short break on Midday. We'll be right back. Well, as you've heard, from housing, employment, education, well, there's also language barriers, Syrian refugees face many challenges when they arrive in a new country. In this segment of the show, we're going to hear about one organization, Lutheran Immigration and Relief Services, a national nonprofit also based here in Baltimore, which works to resettle refugees in a new country. And Mike Mitchell is the Vice President for Programs and Protection at Lutheran Immigration and Relief Services. Thanks for being here, Mike.
You bet. It's good to be here.
You just—you were just up in Detroit. Can you tell us about that experience?
Yeah, I had the opportunity to go meet with two families from Syria, and I had the opportunity to sit down with them. And what was amazing was they had only been in the U.S. for less than a month, and they spoke to me about their journey here. And one of them said to me, when he landed in the U.S., everyone had talked about human rights, but when he landed in the U.S., he understood human rights. And he was there with his two children. And I met another family that had, they had seven boys that they had brought to this country. And they had spent 3 years in these refugee camps that your other guests have spoken about. And they finally made their journey here, and they were really excited to start a new life.
And how did they get here? I mean, under the auspices of our government? How is this done?
The U.S. government has a resettlement program, and it's run by the Department of State. And there are nine agencies. LIRS is one of them, Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service. And what we do is we resettle about 10,500 refugees a year around the United States. There are 45 sites. You mentioned Michigan. We're also in the Washington area. And what we do is we partner with communities because ultimately the communities have to be the ones that welcome these migrants and immigrants and refugees. And they welcome them, whether they be churches, community organizations, and they help them with volunteering, help them get integrated. And come to think of it, in Michigan, it's Syrian Americans that are actually helping Syrians.
I was going to ask you, are there a lot of Syrian Americans around Detroit?
There are. And if you look at immigrants from Syria in the United States, it's actually a small number. It's about 7.8% of roughly a million immigrants from the Middle East. But many of them are there. Actually, many of them are doctors, interestingly. And one of the things I did last week is I spoke to one of them, and he said, many of us were doctors, became doctors in Syria, and we decided to come to the United States. And now we want to help Syrians migrate here and find safety here.
Could you talk for a minute about the number 10,000? How do we arrive at 10,000? I know that comes from the Obama administration, but how do they arrive at that number? And is there any push to increase the number?
Yeah. So that number, I think he was feeling political pressure, but it's not a big enough number. The number right now, we're at about 1,500 for this year, which is about 0.03% of the total number of 4 million. And at LARS and the other resettlement agencies, we'd like to see 100,000 Syrians. And if you go to a place like Michigan, you hear that they actually want to welcome refugees. So I think the Obama administration is watching what Germany is doing and what England is doing and saying, we need to up the number. Hmm. But that doesn't match what, you know, Germany is doing.
Cortland Robinson, associate professor at the Center for Refugee and Disaster Response at Bloomberg School at Hopkins. So I wanted to ask you this. You know, we've heard a lot about immigrants, illegal immigrants, undocumented immigrants in the United States. There's going to be a debate, another debate tonight of the Republican presidential candidates. We're apt to hear about it again, especially from the big man in the room, Donald Trump, right? So, and then Trump turns around and says, well, he thinks, you know, he feels sorry for people who are refugees as a distinct from people who just come into the country illegally, climb over a fence or whatever, and take a job here in the United States. So some people see a contradiction there. They see hypocrisy there. Others see a clear distinction.
I think there's there is a clear distinction. I think there is also the reality that when people are on the move, you get what we often call mixed flows. I think this was true for Indo-Chinese leaving, even for Syrians. It's not the case that if you take a million people on the move, every single one of them is a refugee or all of them might be migrants. I think the new way of thinking about this really says, how do we protect all of those populations with the proper response? And that includes, first and foremost, allowing them to leave a place where they're in danger, not be parked at a border where they're subject to very inhospitable treatment and possibly high risk of mortality and morbidity and illness, but to come to a place where they're allowed to have their case processed. You can process overseas, as the U.S. does, and we admit refugees. Our large number of refugees admitted are coming from overseas, but we also have asylum processing for people who reach our shores and make a claim. We also have people who cross in an undocumented manner, some of whom either don't make a claim or would not have that claim recognized as meeting refugee criteria. I think we still have a humanitarian obligation to find a solution that could include deportation to a place where their life and freedom are not at risk or threat, but also to provide other temporary protected status, right to remain, and so forth. I think it's always about numbers, where somebody once said the rhetoric of welcome meets the politics of limits. So we have this debate going on. It's a tension. I think it's a creative tension, because I think ultimately the U.S., over time, has tended to do the right thing, but you often get these reactive kind of responses saying, build a wall, keep these illegals out, they're right. criminals, they're so forth. I won't re-quote Donald Trump. We all know what he said about Mexicans, but that kind of rhetoric, I think, is not only unhelpful and inhumane, but really, in fundamental ways, ineffective, is not consistent
because
with the U.S. goals.
I was getting to that number 10,000 and wondering, you know, where's the political will going to come from to increase that number? We may see it. It may become bipartisan. Who knows? Because they are, we're talking about refugees, people fleeing a war, right?
We've taken large numbers before. I think with the Indo-Chinese case, we've taken at one point 15,000 a month. So there is capacity, and I think as you alluded to, there is a great deal of welcome among the Syrian American community and others to say, we can help, we can do this. And I think that's true across the country.
I mean, there's precedent for it because in Vietnam, for example, we accepted 150,000 refugees from Vietnam in 1975. The numbers were upwards of 200,000 around the time the Refugee Act was passed. And there have been other times as well, like around the late 80s to the mid-90s, we were accepting maybe 100,000 refugees a year. Now we accept about 70,000 a year, but it's time to bring that number up to match this crisis.
Hey, Mike Mitchell, before you leave us, you know, I mentioned Lutheran World Relief. I mentioned Catholic Relief Services. We had representatives in here just a moment ago from International Orthodox Christian Charities, all based here in Baltimore, right?
Right.
And LIRS, Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Services. And how many countries do you do your work?
Well, most of our work is here domestically.
So it's mostly is resettling people.
It's resettling, right.
Those 70,000 that you just talked about, you're part of it.
We started in 1939 out of Lutheran churches.
So and you don't work overseas settling people in other countries. You work,
correct.
Work is all here.
We welcome people from all over the world in the United States here.
And the extent of the reach is in every state of the country, or is it confined?
It's about 23 states around the United States, but all the way from the West Coast down to Florida, up to New York and Massachusetts and in Minnesota.
So as long as we see refugees still moving, on the move from the Middle East or wherever, Africa, Southern Asia, we're going to see pressure building in the United States to take in more. Is that what you expect?
Yeah, and I think we saw a dip post 9/11 as new security measures came into place, but we've worked that through. I think we have good vetting mechanisms to make sure we don't have people coming in who would be a harm to this country. But I would agree with Mike's view that the crisis calls for more. 10,000 is not an adequate response. We've done more in the past, so we can do it again.
Thank you very much for being here today. Courtland Robinson, Associate Professor over at the Bloomberg School in the Center for Refugee and Disaster Response. And Mike Mitchell is Vice President, just back from Detroit, Vice President for Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Services based here in Baltimore. Thanks very much, Mike.
Thank
you, everybody, for tuning in. That's our first hour of Middays. Please stay tuned for the news from NPR and then the second hour of our show.